Side 2, Hugo Chavez by Judith Levin, continuing on page 57. It is a very Chavez story, his using Bolivar and his quick, convincing arguments to get out of trouble and make a pal of an enemy. Critics of Chavez, or anyone interested in logic, might note that his argument was a lousy one. Even though the two countries have a historical tie to Bolivar, Chavez could still have been a spy. In 1977, Hugo Chavez married Nancy Colmenares, a woman from his hometown of Sabareta. She continued to live there while Chavez served in the military. He told Irma Marksman, a friend and lover, that he could not marry her, that his mother would not give him permission to divorce Nancy. Several people who know Chavez have suggested that his mother wielded a fair amount of power over him, especially since she did not raise him. During his marriage to Nancy, which lasted 18 years, the couple had three children, Rosa Virginia, Maria Gabriela, and Hugo Rafael. Chavez seems to have nothing to say about the marriage, except that he was away a lot, and that they parted amicably. Irma Marksman, who was his girlfriend for 9 or 10 years, later wrote a book called Chavez Used Me, in which she claimed that she helped him with his thesis to graduate from the military academy, and ran errands and carried messages for him during the early days of his political conspiracies. He is, she says, a man without loyalty, who makes use of people and then drops them. After his graduation, Chavez was assigned to a counterinsurgency battalion in Barinas, putting down the last of the guerrilla uprisings. In 1976, he was sent to Cumaná to stop a rebellion. There, he found himself shocked and disgusted by the treatment of the guerrilla fighters. Awakened by the yells of prisoners being beaten with baseball bats, wrapped in cloth so they wouldn't leave marks, Chavez said there would be no torture under his command. Although he was threatened with a court-martial for arguing with a superior officer, it was never carried out. Chavez began to wonder where his loyalties really lay. During the same mission, he says, he watched while soldiers wounded in the fighting lay dying, begging him not to let them die. He wondered, "What am I doing here? On one side, peasants in military uniforms torture peasant guerrillas, and on the other, peasant guerrillas kill peasants dressed in green." It all seemed senseless to him. The people killing one another had more in common than not. They were poor, and they had no real power, although some carried guns. It was an awakening to Chavez, one of those moments when something becomes clear for the first time, when things that one has believed suddenly look different. 23 years old, he organized the Liberation Army of the Venezuelan People. It was a very small organization with, he jokes, fewer members than there were words in the organization's name. "We hadn't the least idea at that time what we were going to do," he admits, "except to prepare ourselves in case something happened." He met another officer, Jesus Urdaneta Hernandez, who soon became a friend, and Chavez told him about the revolutionary group. They thought of it as an alternative to the guerrilla movement, an organization within the army. In 1980, Chavez went back to the military academy in Caracas as a sports instructor, once again able to pursue his love of baseball. He also became a teacher of military history and politics there. The man who would be Venezuela's defense minister during Chavez's attempted coup in 1998 taught with him at the academy during the early 1980s and remembers Chavez as a good speaker and a good motivator. It was during this time that Chavez became convinced that at some point during his career, military officers would be needed to run the government of Venezuela. Venezuela was in a political and economic crisis. In the 1970s, oil prices had been high and the Venezuelan economy had seemed strong. Chavez knew from experience that this had not helped most of the poor people in his hometown or others like them, but as in the 1870s and 1880s, a strong economy made for a secure government. During the 1960s, presidents were elected democratically, and in 1969, for the first time in Venezuelan history, power passed smoothly from one party to the other after an election. Yet many people began to believe that power passed too smoothly, and in fact, was really staying in the same people's hands. The two parties, COPEI and AD, signed the Pact of Punto Fijo, named for the place it was signed, in 1958, which said that they would share power and take turns governing. Yet over time, the platforms of the two parties merged and blurred. It seemed to be a one-party system pretending to be a two-party system. So people could vote, but voting seemed meaningless if it didn't matter which candidate was elected. Although these governments may genuinely have wanted change to make people's lives better, they were mired in bureaucracy. Carlos Andrés Pérez of the AD party spent more money between 1974 and 1979 than all Venezuela's previous governments put together. Yet so much of the money disappeared through corruption and inefficiency that he left behind huge debts, $8 billion, inflation, and an unstable economy. It wasn't just that programs for the poor didn't work, but that it was nearly impossible to register a car, get a passport, or even get a phone hooked up. People might have to pay bribes to get a phone line, and even then they often couldn't get a dial tone because the company had 40-year-old, outdated, half-broken equipment. Additionally, in a system where many more people were paid than worked, and many saw their jobs as a secure base from which to collect bribes, ordinary people would find themselves in the ludicrous position of having to bribe someone in order to pay their taxes. Yet people had to be able to prove that they had paid their taxes on property, for instance, if they wanted to sell it, so there they were, having to bribe a government employee to take the money that the government badly needed. Venezuelan economist Robert Potome says there was not a single public service, education, healthcare, housing, anything, that was working. But as long as the economy was strong, nothing changed. Oil would fund everything, people believed. That belief was, and still is, built into the culture and the way Venezuelans think about themselves. The country is rich in oil, and so, people believe, if only that money was handed around better, surely there would be enough for everyone. As Christian Parenti writes, the whole culture has been mama state, papa state, give me oil money. That is the voice of children asking for an allowance, not the voice of people creating a working economy. And yet there remained the obvious injustice of some people having had all that oil money while so many other people suffered. The stereotype of Venezuelans in the 1970s was of women shopping in Florida or in Paris and always saying, "That's so cheap, I'll take two," so that they were called dame dos, the give me two ladies. The unit of currency, called the bolívar, was worth so much that even the most expensive designer clothes in other countries were cheap. Also, imported goods were cheap. Even the very poor people of Venezuela acquired televisions during that time, perhaps as many of 98% of people in Caracas, far more than could get telephones. But by the time Chavez was in the military, the economy was coming apart. The price of oil had fallen, and with it, the value of the bolívar. Most people had less and less money, and people who had been middle class became poor. In December of 1982, Chavez was unexpectedly ordered to make a speech to 1,200 officers and troops. Without notes, perhaps without having even planned what he was going to say, Chavez began to speak about Latin America's history of oppression. 200 years after its independence from Spain, he said, people were still oppressed. The commander of the military base, Colonel Manrique, hearing about the speech, berated him, saying, "Chavez, you sound like a politician." Captain Felipe Acosta Carles, one of the men who agreed with Chavez, said, "You are wrong, my commander. Chavez is no politician. He is a captain of today's men, and when you hear what he said in his speech, you will piss in your pants." Colonel Manrique told the troops that Chavez had spoken without his permission or knowledge, and ordered that none of what Chavez had said was to be spoken of off the base. Hugo Chavez, Felipe Acosta Carles, Jesus Urdaneta Hernandez, and Colonel Rafael Baduel traveled on horseback to Saman del Guere, 6 miles away, near Maracay. At the site of a famous tree, where Bolívar is said to have rested, they swore the oath Bolívar had sworn in Rome in 1805, when he pledged himself to freeing Latin America from Spanish rule. Only a few words had to be changed. The men said, in part, "I swear before you, and I swear before the God of my fathers, that I will not allow my arm to relax, nor my soul to rest, until I break the chains that oppress us and oppress the people by will of the powerful." Bolívar had said, "Until I break the chains that oppress us by will of Spanish power." The men took this oath to bind themselves to a new organization, Revolutionary Bolivarian Movement, 200, named for the 200th anniversary of Bolívar's birth. It was started, Richard Gott said, more as a political study group than as a subversive conspiracy. Still, from their study of the problems of their country, they began to believe that a coup d'état, a military overthrow of the government, would be necessary. Venezuela's democracy seemed to them to be failing, as the two parties passed power back and forth. It might as well be a dictatorship, they believed. Everything has basically remained the same, Chavez said later, in 1999. It's been the same system of domination, whether the leader rode a horse or drove a Mercedes-Benz. Leaders became rich and corrupt. Ordinary people, the majority of Venezuelans, still could not determine their own destiny. As the movement grew, military intelligence agencies became aware that something was going on, though they probably didn't know how many people were involved. Richard Gott suggested that the military authorities did know that a number of popular and successful young officers were involved, and so it would have been difficult to discharge them all from the army. Instead, recognizing Chavez as a likely troublemaker, authorities transferred him in 1986 away from the military academy, where he could influence so many young people, to the far reaches of Venezuela, to Elorza in the state of Apure, close to the border of Colombia. Once there, Chavez was prevented from political organizing, yet he was able to put to the test some of his political theories. In Elorza, Chavez used the military base as a place to experiment with cooperation between the military and civilians, organizing oral history programs, and providing military support for social and economic development in the area. In 1988, the military reassigned Chavez again, this time back to Caracas, to the presidential palace of Miraflores. Captions to photographs. 1. President Salvador Allende committed suicide before he could be captured in a coup led by General Augusto Pinochet on September 11, 1973. Soldiers and firefighters carry Allende's body out of his destroyed presidential palace. 2. Although Chavez was transferred from the military academy, he would soon return to Caracas to work in the presidential palace. This photograph shows the contrast between Caracas's downtown skyscrapers and its slum housing. End of captions. Chapter 6. The 1989 Riots and the 1992 Coup Attempt. On February 27, 1989, riots began in the streets of Guarenas, a town 30 kilometers, 19 miles, east of Caracas, and then spread to Caracas and nearby towns. The trigger was something that seems small. That morning, people went to get on their regular buses to go to work and discovered that the bus fares had doubled. What began as dismayed grumbling rapidly escalated into a full-scale riot. People flipped over buses and set them on fire, and young people began to pour down the mountains from Caracas's huge barrio into the wealthy city center, smashing store windows, looting from them, and then burning the stores. They looted houses and burned whole city blocks. The riots, the worst in Venezuela's history, came to be called the Caracazo. It might be translated as the Caracas Smash, since the ending aso suggests a blow. The Caracazo was like a nightmare come true for the richer people who lived and worked in the city. Caracas was, and is, two cities. One is a sleek, noisy, modern city of glass skyscrapers, expensive stores, fancy malls, and restaurants. The wealthy live on the slopes of Mount Avila in large houses with pools and gardens that are fenced off by walls topped with razor wire and defended by private security guards. On the other side of the mountain are Caribbean beaches. It is an elegant city that fulfilled Guzman Blanco's 19th century dream of a city on par with the great cities of Europe. The other Caracas is the shanty towns, barrios, that have grown up around Caracas on the steep hills that frequently collapse during the rainy season. The houses are shacks made of flattened metal cans, cardboard, canvas, and scraps of wood. They are constructed illegally, yet since 1958, the government has often allowed people to stay, not knowing where else to put them. Often, after a few years of not having to pay rent, people in the barrios will begin to replace their houses with ones made of brick, but they are without running water or sewers. Some of the houses do have electricity, though, since they are able to illegally tap the electrical lines. Even before the riots, the well-to-do of Caracas feared the shanty dwellers and imagined them as a kind of subhuman, entirely lawless people. Recently, wealthier people in Caracas told journalist Alma Guillero Prieto, thieves, murderers, drug addicts, chavistas swarm in those heights. She said the shanty towns looked to her like a lot of places where poor people are coming home from school and parents are taking care of their families and trying to earn a living. It is true, though, that Caracas had become a dangerous city with a high crime rate. In the riots, as in riots everywhere, all the old pent-up anger came out. The riots continued for 1.5 days, unchecked. As televisions, and remember, nearly every family had a television, showed the rioters, others joined in. When at last the military was called in, it intervened, brutally. People died inside their houses as bullets came through the walls. Chavez later said, "You know, you send soldiers into the street, scared, with a rifle and 500 bullets, and they fire them all. They spray the streets with bullets, the hills, the poor barrios." They did, ending the riots at the cost of many lives, including that of Chavez's friend and co-conspirator, Felipe Acosta, who Chavez believes was assassinated. No one knows for certain how many people died in the riots. Official estimates say that about 300 people died, but others have claimed that the government buried bodies in mass graves and that the real number might be in the thousands. When, years later, the government paid out money to the families of those who had been killed, they awarded money to 1,000 families. The riots came at a time when no one was expecting them, not the government and not Chavez and his revolutionaries. Chavez, in fact, was running a fever and had been ordered home to bed, though he says he was on his way to the university when he saw soldiers running everywhere and realized what was happening. Why was everyone caught off guard? Why did a bus fare increase, however inconvenient, spark such violence? It goes back to what had been happening in Venezuelan politics and economics since about the time of Chavez's birth, or in a way since colonial days. Venezuela's stability had been based on the two-party system and on the high oil prices that ensured that there was lots of money flowing through the economy. But the oil market collapsed. Venezuela had been a founding member of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in 1960, an organization created to limit the amount of oil for sale at any one time and thus to control its price. Yet Venezuela had been just one of the countries that then failed to abide by OPEC's agreement. It wanted to sell as much oil as possible and did not consider that the prices would fall if there was too much of it. The oil glut made prices plummet in 1979 and then again beginning in 1986. The exchange value of the Bolivar fell, and Venezuela found itself heavily in debt. In February 1989, Carlos Andrés Pérez of the AD party was in his third week of re-election. In accordance with the Constitution of 1960, he had had to wait 10 years after the end of his last term to run for the office again. It was a rule meant to keep any one president from having power for too long, crafted by people who had endured too many years of dictatorship. Pérez had been popular in his first term, which had begun in 1973. But when Pérez was re-elected, he faced an economy in deep trouble. The average income per person had dropped by more than 75% since 1977, and the Bolívar was worth about 90% less than it had been 5 years earlier. Store owners had begun to hoard food, knowing that anything they sold would cost more to restock, and that if they held on to their stock, they could sell it for more money very soon. Even bread, milk, cornmeal, and beans became expensive. Pérez had campaigned on a platform of promises he couldn't keep. He told people what they wanted to hear, that oil would save them, but only days into his term of office, he had to put into effect a series of financial reforms that went against everything he had promised. On February 16th, Pérez had announced a series of measures designed to stabilize the economy. During his first term in office, Pérez had nationalized the iron, steel, and oil industries, subsidized food and oil prices, and forgiven, canceled, $350 million in debts owed to the government by Venezuelan farmers. He supported the Bolívar at a high value so that it could always be exchanged at the bank for a high price in dollars. Ordinarily, the worth of a nation's currency fluctuates naturally, but a government can keep the worth of the currency high, although it is very expensive to do so. But when Pérez took office for the second time, Venezuela couldn't pay its debts to foreign nations or to the World Bank. In order for Venezuela to get the loans it needed and time to pay off its debts, Pérez had to agree to a series of measures designed to stabilize the economy. These measures went against everything he had done during his first term and everything he had promised for the second, but they were required of him by the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. They included privatizing state companies, removing subsidies from oil and food, for instance, and letting the Bolívar fall in value. So many Latin American economies faced financial crises in the 1980s that a series of policies called the Washington Consensus were developed to address them. The policies include the ones mentioned above, and also lower taxes on people in high income brackets, and elimination of regulations that get in the way of economic competition. It emphasizes national and international competition. Although the policy's supporters believe that in the long run it creates a healthy economy, many other people, including Chavez and some economists, believe the policies look out for the interests of big businesses, but not those of the people, especially poor people. Visited upon Venezuela without warning, the policies wreaked havoc. One part of these measures was that the price of oil, which was always sold extremely cheaply to Venezuelans, subsidized by the government, would double on Sunday, February 26th. The government had told the bus companies not to pass on the entire cost of the increase to riders at the same time, but rather to raise fares a little at a time. But the bus companies saw no reason to absorb the cost themselves, so they did double the fares that Monday. The force of the riots, the violence of the military response, and the shock of upper-class Venezuelans showed that tensions and troubles ran deeper than bus fares, deeper than a disrupted economy. It was also the result of the historical gap between rich and poor, people of color, and the white quasi-aristocracy. Before the riots, Venezuelan journalist Francisco Toro explained, Venezuelans saw themselves and were seen by others as the successful democracy in Latin America. They were different, better, more modern than other countries in the region. They drank the most expensive Scotch whiskey and drove Jaguars. They were Venezuela Saudita, Saudi Venezuela, rich and modern. The Caracazo was very much the sort of event that Chavez and his supporters had been waiting for, but they were entirely unprepared to take advantage of it. Compared to the 1958 rebellion in which the Patriotic Junta had overthrown dictator General Pérez Jiménez, the 1989 riots were chaotic and leaderless. But the Caracazo riots were, Chavez believes, a response to Washington consensus programs and to the further betrayal of the poor. Returning to work at the presidential palace of Miraflores after the Caracazo, Chavez says that the palace guards questioned him about the Bolivarian movement. "We'd like to know more about it. We're not prepared to go on killing people," he reports they're saying. Chavez saw this as a good sign. It was like when he rebelled against the killing of the guerrillas. Members of the military were saying that they wanted to do something other than shoot poor people. Although there is no way to verify that this happened, it does show us the development of Chavez's thinking about the role of the military. He wanted them to have a role that didn't involve killing. He wanted them to work on rebuilding the country. Many of Chavez's programs, once he was in power, would involve using the military to work with communities. On December 6th, Chavez and some other officers were accused of plotting a coup or even an assassination of the president and other government officials. Although not convicted, everyone accused was sent far away from the palace. Chavez was sent to Maturin, but was allowed to continue his graduate work at Simón Bolívar University in Caracas. In 1991, Chavez was given the command of a paratrooper battalion based about 80 kilometers, 50 miles, from Caracas in Maracay. From there, Chavez was able to plan the coup, codenamed Plan Zamora, after the 19th century general who Chavez so admired. As plans for a coup took shape, Chavez and some of his allies began to disagree among themselves. Guerrilla fighter Douglas Bravo, for instance, wanted the coup to begin with civilian action, probably a general strike, with all workers leaving their jobs. Later, the coup against Chavez began with civilian action. But Chavez, a member of the military his whole adult life, said no, civilians get in the way. We shall summon them when we get into power. There were few plans made for what would happen after the coup until very late in the planning. In fact, there was also a lot of disagreement about when the coup would take place. Some junior commanders said they would launch their own coup if Chavez and his colleagues didn't get moving. But Chavez was told that on February 14, 1992, he would be transferred to a small village near the border of Colombia, so he and the other senior commanders set a date. The plan was coordinated with President Pérez's return from the World Economic Forum in Switzerland on Tuesday, February 4th. Chavez said goodbye to his wife and their children, having made sure she had extra money in the house. Later, when he left his barracks with the soldiers, his last act was to lock the gate behind him and throw away the key. I realized at that moment that I was saying goodbye to life, Chavez says. While military forces elsewhere in the country were capturing the barracks at Maracay and other cities, Chavez and five army units marched into Caracas. The units had different tasks. One unit would capture the defense ministry, one would take over Miraflores Palace, and one would go to the airport where Perez was due to return and take him to the historical museum, where Chavez, with his experience in communications equipment, was setting up a base. Crucially, the forces sent to capture the president failed. Someone had betrayed the conspiracy, and the president was too well guarded to be captured. When Chavez arrived at the museum, he and his troops were fired upon. But, remember the Chavez who talked his way out of Colombia, he was actually able to talk his way out of the situation. He told the colonel who had taken charge of guarding the museum that he and his troops were on their side. However, having gained access to the museum, he discovered that the communications equipment he needed was not there. He had no way to address the Venezuelan people and call for an uprising against the president. Some sources say that the inability to broadcast recorded tapes to the public took place at a television station. The troops trying to take over the palace also failed, and Mrs. Perez, the president's wife, helped the palace guard defend it. In other parts of the country, the coup was coming off as planned, and troops took over military barracks and cities, including Aragua and Valencia. But without holding the key positions in Caracas or capturing the president, the coup was a failure. On February 4th, early in the morning, President Perez, who, when he escaped capture, went not to a fort but to a TV station, announced on television that there had been a rebellion but that it was being put down. At 9 o'clock, Chavez surrendered but persuaded authorities that he be allowed to speak on TV to avoid bloodshed and ensure the peaceful surrender of the troops elsewhere. 14 soldiers had already died, and 50 soldiers and 80 civilians were wounded. But also, Chavez says now, he wanted to take the initiative, not to turn up later on TV as a defeated-looking captive. Perez had told his officers to tape Chavez's words so that they could be edited. But the soldiers didn't want to slow down Chavez's TV appearance and the surrender of the other coup members. They put him on the air live, and as is so often true of Chavez, he found that an inner voice rose up in him and the words just spilled out. To this day, he can repeat the speech word for word. Chavez said, in part, "Comrades, the objectives we set for ourselves have not been possible to achieve for the moment, but new possibilities will arise again, and the country will be able to move forward to a better future. I alone take responsibility for this Bolivarian military uprising." On the printed page, the words don't sound magical, but they made him a hero in under a minute. Richard Gott said it is not only the words, for the moment, that made an impact. He said that in Venezuela it was unknown for a leader to say that he accepted responsibility for anything or to apologize. In all the years of bank collapses, corruption trials, and misery, no politician had ever apologized or taken responsibility for what they had done or for what had happened on their watch. Among his co-conspirators, Chavez was anything but a hero. He had failed while they had succeeded, and he had, they felt, surrendered much too fast. "Why had he given up so fast?" co-conspirator Commander Urdanta asked him. "I was lonely," he reported Chavez as having replied. Urdaneta pointed out that Chavez, like all the other commanders, had his soldiers and his officers with him. Commander Arias, having asked the same question, got the same reply. "I was left alone, without being able to communicate. I missed you." Jose Ruiz, in whose home a younger Chavez had first read about communism and socialism, refused to visit Chavez in prison. He said, "He should have gone all the way, even if that killed him." Chavez was sentenced to a long jail term, but he would be pardoned after only 2 years. The attempted coup, still in the aftermath of the Caracazo, had a deep effect on the political situation. President Perez would be more blamed than praised for surviving the coup. Ex-President Rafael Caldera made a speech that seemed to support the coup more than it supported the president and his government. Caldera said, noting the lack of popular support for the president, "It is difficult to ask people to sacrifice themselves in a struggle to defend liberty and democracy when you know that that democracy and the rule of law have not been able to provide them with food or to put a stop to the terrible round of corruption that has eroded the institutional legality of the country." In November 1992, there was another coup attempt, during which the Miraflores Palace was bombed, and in Caracas and Maracay, more than 170 people died in the fighting. This coup failed in part because of another failure in communications and broadcasting. The conspirators took control of a TV station. They were supposed to play a video that would give people the signal to take to the streets in protest against the government. But the conspirators played the wrong tape. When the signal came, an Air Force plane flying over the palace, no one knew what it meant. They had no way of recognizing it as a signal. And, suggested Gott, people could hardly support a coup so disorganized that they couldn't put the right tape in the VCR. It was, again, a political action that hinged on the use of the media and TV. Although the coups failed, President Pérez was becoming an embarrassment to his own party. He was ousted from power on corruption charges, which may or may not have been trumped up to dispose of him. Certainly, the corruption was real. In one 1989 case, public officials were discovered to have stolen more than $8 billion through a variety of schemes. Caldera was elected for a second term on the strength of being anti-Pérez and understanding about people's discontent. Yet neither was he able to fix the economic and social problems of the country. Businesses continued to collapse, and Venezuelans with money continued to take it and themselves to other countries. Yaris Prison, where Chavez was sent, is not a nice place. The worst inmates are left to their own devices in two dirty white, bullet-pocked blocks at the rear of the prison grounds, where black curtains of excrement from broken toilets slide down the walls, reported John Lee Anderson in 2001. Many of the prisoners carry guns. Yet for Chavez, prison was not entirely a bad experience. He had a chair in the open air, protected from other prisoners. He had a plaster bust of Simón Bolívar to talk to, but he was also allowed real visitors to talk to. He was allowed TV and radio interviews. He was treated as an imprisoned military officer, not as a criminal, and he used at least part of the time to plan future rebellions. Among Chavez's visitors were his wife, Nancy, and their children. Rosa, at age 14, could only cry, he says, but 12-year-old Maria, he says proudly, was glad to see him and full of personal news. She wrote him letters saying that she had some understanding of her father's political activities. "Now I finally understand why you used to arrive home at night worn out, and why you bored us sitting there reading A Prayer to Simón Bolívar in the Black Night of the Americas." But also, he says, she told him that she was so proud to be his daughter that she wanted to shout it out on the bus, "I am Comandante Chavez's daughter." This is not to say that prison was fun. "We experienced all the human misery there. We came into direct contact with it," says Chavez. One of its long-term effects is that he developed an eye problem that was not treated properly, leaving him with permanent damage to his vision. But in the end, he told interviewer Aleida Guevara, daughter of revolutionary Che Guevara, "those of us who confronted life in prison consciously, with dignity and integrity, left it strengthened." In March 1994, newly elected President Caldera released the coup leaders from prison. Chavez was, by this time, so popular a figure that all the candidates had had to promise to free him. When Chavez was asked at the first press conference, "What are you going to do now?" he replied instantly, "I am going to get into power." He did not know if this was possible. Captions to photographs. 1. Heavily armed personnel carriers drive through Caracas, Venezuela, on March 2, 1989, after 3 days of violent riots left 200 people dead. 2. Carlos Andrés Pérez rides in a presidential motorcade in 1989, 3 years before the bloody coup attempt. 3. Rafael Caldera walks to the presidential palace after presenting a State of the Union address on March 13, 1997. Caldera was president of Venezuela from 1969 to 1974, and from 1994 to 1999, just before Chavez's term. End of captions. Chapter 7. The Election of Chavez. Released from prison, Chavez began to reorganize his life, politically and personally. He divorced his wife, Nancy, something he doesn't discuss. He also reformed the MVR 200 as Movimiento Quinta República, MVR. The V is for the Roman numeral 5, as in the Fifth Republic. Since Venezuela's declaration of independence from Spain in 1811, Venezuela had had four republics. Soon after leaving prison, Chavez was invited to Cuba, where, in September 1994, he was greeted warmly by Fidel Castro. While the United States has maintained an embargo on Cuba since Castro came into power in 1959, Latin American countries have more often remained on cordial terms with him. Returning from Cuba, Chavez began to travel around the country, talking to people. He wanted to find out if people would vote for him, or if there needed to be another coup, which would have been crazy, he concluded. He also talked about the idea of a constitutional assembly. He wanted a group of people to rewrite the Constitution as a way of reorganizing the government, and he wanted that group to include ordinary people, not just politicians. Rewriting the Constitution is how most new governments in Venezuela's history began. Chavez started to believe that there would be real support for him as a presidential candidate. He began to campaign for office. Toward the end of 1996, while campaigning for office, Chavez met his second wife, the journalist Marisabel Rodriguez. They married in a private ceremony in December of 1997, when their daughter Rosa Inés, named for Chavez's grandmother, was 3 months old. Marisabel already had a son, Raúl Alfonso. Critics of Chavez say that Marisabel was the perfect choice for a Venezuelan presidential candidate, a pretty, blonde, blue-eyed, light-skinned woman. Chavez continued to travel widely during the campaign, crisscrossing the country, meeting with every fire chief and parish priest, wrote the American Spectator, sounding somewhat sarcastic about the matter. But his willingness to talk to ordinary people is one of his strengths. "I don't think that we skipped a single city, town, encampment, Indian village, or neighborhood," Chavez says with some pride. He had always been a charismatic speaker, with seemingly limitless energy and vibrancy. His staff, when he became president, says he sleeps very little and consumes a tremendous amount of coffee. In recent years, they have cut him down from 26 to 16 cups of espresso a day. He is tremendously skilled in speaking impromptu, for hours, and making connections to people. And as an obviously mixed-race candidate, and one from a poor background, he represents for the majority of Venezuelan people someone who looks like them and speaks like them, who shares their concerns. Chavez's campaign platform had three main points. 1. The end of Punto Fijismo, the deal between the Christian Democratic Party, COPEI, and the Social Democratic Action Party, AD, that ensured that only their candidates would take turns controlling the presidency. 2. The end of political corruption. 3. The end of poverty in Venezuela. These were lofty goals, but appealing ones, except to members of COPEI and AD. Estimates say that 80% of Venezuelans were still living in poverty, and 33% were working for, or at least getting paychecks from, the bloated government bureaucracies. And the corruption was so out of control that one politician who admitted that oil money was illegally flowing into his open pockets came up with this slogan about himself: "He dunks, but he splashes." In other words, "I'm stealing lots, but that's okay because I share." In 1998, Transparency International, an international watchdog organization, identified Venezuela as one of the 10 most corrupt countries in the world, all of which is worth keeping in mind when Chavez's current opponents bemoan the good old days of pre-Chavez democracy in Venezuela. Many people watching the campaign found Chavez to be a mystery man, a chameleon in a mirror. He spoke of boiling politicians' heads in oil, but as the elections grew closer, he suggested that he would be willing to work with the business community. Sometimes he wore his military uniform, which was against military regulations since he had resigned from the military after leaving prison, and a revolutionary's red beret. At other times, he dressed in a conservative shirt and tie. Was Chavez a fiery revolutionary, or just another populist candidate who would settle down within the system once elected? No one was sure. People magazine ran a short article on the elections, called "Not Just a Pretty Face." The pretty face in question was not Chavez's, but that of one of his main opponents. "Former Miss Universe Irene Saiz vies to become Venezuela's first woman president," said the article's subhead. 6 months before the election, Saiz had about a 22% approval rating in the polls, ahead of all but Chavez in a field of 12 candidates. Although people said her looks certainly didn't do her any harm in a country that prides itself on its beautiful women and produces Miss Universe beauty pageant winners with some regularity, the writer also noted that she had experience in politics. She was serving her second term as mayor of the richest borough of Caracas and came from a solidly conservative, well-to-do background. Her campaign platform issues included better education, smaller government, and law and order. She had won with 96% of the vote in her second term as mayor, having cut crime, kept the streets clean, and also outlawing excessive kissing in the streets. Ironically, it was Copé's decision to back Sáenz that may have led to her loss. The old two-party system was indeed on its last legs, and not having a candidate of their own, Copé decided to throw their support behind the candidate that was most clearly one of them, socially and economically, and likely to win. Their support resulted in her approval rating dropping from 22% 6 months before the election to 2%. Copé then withdrew its support and announced that it backed Enrique Salas Rumer, another conservative candidate. In the election, on December 6, 1998, Chávez won with slightly more than 54% of the vote. Salas received only 39%. It was the first time a candidate not of the two parties had won. It was the largest majority by which a candidate had won an election in all the 40 years of Venezuelan democracy. Yet at the same time, it was a tremendously unpopular election result among people who owned large businesses and among foreign investors. After the election, even more people with money left the country, and foreign investors pulled $1.7 billion out of Venezuela. In 1999, 600,000 jobs would be lost. President Hugo Rafael Chávez Frías took office on February 2, 1999. While still in prison, he had planned to write his thesis about how to turn his Bolivarian movement into a government. Although the thesis was never finished, he now could try his ideas out in real life. He began immediately to try to put into effect his campaign promises. He turned part of the presidential palace into a high school for homeless teens and made corporations pay taxes that hadn't paid taxes in previous years, or ever. He also started his Plan Bolivar 2000. It was based on his belief that the military can have a variety of roles in national life, some of them having nothing to do with guns. He wanted to use the military to institute social and economic improvement for the poor and in rural regions. 40,000 soldiers would help with such things as the building of roads and housing, conducting mass vaccinations, and delivering food. In an interview in 2002, Chávez said, "My order was, go house to house combing the terrain. Who is the enemy? Hunger. And we started it on February 27, 1999, 10 years after the Caracaso, as a way of vindicating the military. 10 years ago, we came out to massacre the people. Now we are going to fill them with love." 1 year after the Caracaso, the news magazine Momento had run a special issue. Its cover said, in Spanish, "1 year after the 27th of February, 1,000 deaths and nothing changes." Chávez wanted people to feel that something had changed, and given that the price of oil was extremely low, $8 a barrel, when he came to office, and the country was deeply in debt, he was in a difficult position. Chávez had come into office promising a new constitution, which had last been rewritten in 1961. In order to accomplish these things, Chávez called for two national votes. Chávez asked people to vote on whether they wanted to create a National Constitutional Assembly, a body that would write the new constitution. The second vote was to elect members of that assembly. The vote on the referendum to rewrite the constitution passed overwhelmingly, 71.78% to 28.22%. However, as with other votes, many people, 55.63% of the population, abstained, which in Venezuelan history suggests that people protested by not voting. Chávez's party, the MVR, and its allies, then received enough votes to give them 120 seats of 131 total in the Constitutional Assembly. The Assembly also had toll-free telephone lines installed so that ordinary people could call in opinions, and some members of the Assembly traveled around the country and organized regional assemblies to discuss the new constitution. Although formed for the purpose of writing a new constitution, the Constitutional Assembly itself was an independent branch of government. In August 1999, it created a judicial emergency committee able to remove judges from their jobs. It removed 8 of the 15 members of the Supreme Court on the grounds of corruption. It then declared a legislative emergency and said that the National Assembly, the bicameral, two-house, branch of government, like the U.S. Congress, could not meet at all. In the new constitution, the name of the country was changed to the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. It lengthened the presidential term from 5 years to 6 years, and allowed a president to serve two terms in succession. In what would appear to be a check on greatly enlarged presidential powers, it made a provision for a presidential recall referendum, allowing voters to call for a vote to remove the president from office once they had collected enough signatures on petitions. The new Constitution changed the National Assembly from a bicameral legislature to a unicameral one. The new Constitution also forbade the privatization of the oil companies owned by the state and extended labor and Social Security benefits. There were many other changes in the very long document, including a list of the rights of Venezuela's indigenous peoples. The new Constitution, voted into effect in December of 1999, consolidated presidential powers in ways that made Chavez's opponents very nervous. His supporters considered it a constitution that would allow Chavez to carry out his reforms and weed out old, complacent, or even corrupt parts of government. The changes in the Constitution, as well as many of Chavez's actions after that, and the behavior of the Constitutional Assembly, led Chavez's critics, within Venezuela and outside, including in the United States, to question whether the process was democratic at all, or whether Chavez was gradually turning into a particularly charismatic caudillo, strongman, dictator, of the sort that Venezuela knows so well. One of Chavez's political goals is to move people away from the poorest parts of the cities and back to the countryside, to self-sustaining agro-industrial communities. He wants to repopulate the countryside. The need to remove some of the shanty towns was made obvious the same day the country voted on the new constitution. Most of Venezuela doesn't have a cold winter, but it does have a rainy season, as much as 60 to 80 inches, 152 to 203 centimeters, in the Llanos, and about 33 inches, 84 centimeters, around Caracas. That's only about as much rain as Chicago gets each year, but Caracas gets most of it in one season, within a few weeks. It often causes landslides, but in December of 1999, the Avila Mountain north of Caracas exploded as especially heavy rains washed houses, people, and the land itself right off the mountainside. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their homes and stores. 15,000 to 20,000 died. Chavez took it as a chance to show what the military could do, and people were housed in stadiums, in soccer fields, and in tents near army installations. Chavez, wearing his revolutionary red beret and his camouflage uniform, oversaw the operation. About 2,000 of the people made homeless eventually agreed to move to one of Chavez's new communities, far from the city. Richard Gott, usually a supporter of Chavez's plans, questioned whether this desire of Chavez to move people out of the cities may be utopian, in the sense that it is an ideal, but an impossible ideal. The choice, as Gott said Colonel Manrique stated, is this: do you stay in a familiar place, among friends and neighbors, having trouble making a living, and also knowing that your neighborhood will fall down the mountain every 20 years or so? Or do you go live in the countryside, with strange bugs and no city, far away from everything familiar, and hope that the government actually gives you the land and the job it promised? The landslide, and an estimated $15 billion price tag to rebuild structures and relocate people, did not make Chavez's first year in office any easier. Further elections, in July 2000, were held to elect a new National Assembly. Chavez's wife and brother both ran for office and won seats on it, and to re-elect Chavez himself under the terms of the new Constitution. Although Chavez's critics have claimed that all the elections are rigged and do not accurately reflect how people have voted, the elections have all been monitored by the Carter Center, ex-President Jimmy Carter's center for checking the fairness and accuracy of international elections. Only the July elections of 2000 were not validated by the Carter Center, which stated that government pressure and lack of transparency made it impossible to say if the election results were valid or not. That this was an exception among Chavez-initiated elections doesn't comfort his opponents much. The question of whether Chavez would use his presidency to unify the country and include and respect the views of people who had not voted for him was beginning to have an answer: no. Furthermore, on December 3, 2000, Chavez angered the labor unions by backing a law that would require the unions to hold state-monitored elections. That is the sort of interference unions do not want, and Chavez's demand was condemned by international labor groups. Labor leaders admitted that there was corruption within labor unions, they just didn't want Chavez taking them over. Finally, Chavez proposed and had the National Assembly pass something called an Enabling Act. Under the provisions of this act, Chavez could rule by decree for a year. He could make laws that did not have to be passed by the Congress. These were intended, said Richard Gott, to revolutionize the country's infrastructure. The two previous presidents had asked for and been given similar powers. Before the act expired in November 2001, Chavez enacted 49 decrees. These decrees included provisions for the government to seize and redistribute land, including privately owned land, that was not being used, and give it to others. This could include government land or the large country estates of wealthy businessmen. The basis of Chavez's political and economic moves, including the most radical, is his Bolivarian revolution. Chavez says that the goals of Bolivarianism, which include his campaign promises but go further, are 1. Venezuela will have complete sovereignty and not give in to international imperialistic forces. 2. Popular votes and referenda will assure the political participation of Venezuela's people, hence his helping create a constitution that allows for presidential recalls. 3. Economic self-sufficiency. He wants more of Venezuela's food and consumer goods to be produced within the country. 4. That there will be support for patriotic service. 5. Fair and equitable distribution of Venezuela's oil revenue. 6. Elimination of corruption. 7. Elimination of punto fijismo, the two-party system that excluded members of other parties from the presidency. Obviously, Chavez's approach to government and economics is the opposite of the Washington consensus methods of repairing a damaged economy. Its emphasis is on the redistribution of money and resources and on social welfare programs. Even the new constitution is pro-labor and makes business owners fear the cost of doing business in Venezuela. So, there were economic reasons for many people to distrust and dislike Chavez, even before he was elected. They believed, and still believe, that he is bad for democracy, bad for the economy, and bad for international relations with the United States and much of Europe. There are also reasons that have to do with who Chavez is, socially, racially, and educationally. He does not sound like a president to his critics. They dislike the folksy manner, it's the word used over and over again, he uses while speaking on Alo Presidente. They don't want a president who rambles on, and who sings. When he appeared on his television show holding a flashlight while military doctors performed an operation, he then joked, "You see, now I can even do surgery." The day after that broadcast, some wealthy Venezuelans said, "Did you see our clown prince last night?" They don't just think it is sort of silly. They find him really embarrassing, folksy, corny, undignified. They say of him, "The peon, landless peasant, has taken over the farm. El peón ha tornado la finca." Some middle and upper-class Venezuelans call him ese mono, that monkey. They make a pun of mi comandante, my commander, instead saying he is mico mondante, order-giving monkey. He is to them, says reporter Alma Guillermo Prieto, the Zambo, the half-breed, who has empowered other Zambos like him to feel at home in their restaurants and beachside resorts. Their restaurants. Chavez says, "There is racism here. It used to be more hidden, and now it is more open." And so Chavez is, for many people, an enemy, not only because they dislike his economic and political policies, but because they dislike having a man of mixed blood in the presidential palace. He does not sound like them, and he does not look like them. He looks like their servants, like the guy who should be collecting garbage. Many people love him for those same reasons, but since Chavez's response to this has been to call his opponents rancid oligarchs and squealing pigs, and the squalid ones, the political divisions in the country grow and grow. And from early on, his opponents have wanted to bring him down. Captions to photographs. 1. Fidel Castro embraces Hugo Chavez at the University of Havana, Cuba, on December 14, 1994. 2. Former Miss Universe Irene Saiz was unable to beat Chavez in Venezuela's 1998 presidential race. 3. President Hugo Chavez briefs paratroopers on December 18, 1999, before their departure to rescue flood survivors in Venezuela. The natural disaster left more than 200 dead and 7,000 missing. End of captions. Chapter 8. The 2002 Coup d'État Attempt. Before the coup against Chavez in 2002, his political opponents had tried various means to force him out of office. In 2001, retired General Fernando Ochoa Antich told journalist John Lee Anderson, "There is a growing movement within the opposition to unseat Chavez by means that are neither conventional, electoral, nor democratic. The hope is that this situation will not bring about a military coup, that it will be dealt with using constitutional means." He spoke of a situation in which Chavez would resign, although the general said he couldn't quite imagine how this would come about. Many work stoppages and strikes took place as protests against the president. By the end of 2001, street vendors in Caracas were selling CDs of the sound of banging pots to people who wanted to drown out and protest their president's long speeches. On April 9, 2002, Carlos Ortega Carvajal, the leader of Venezuela's largest union federation, Venezuelan Workers Confederation, traditional allies of the AD party, called for a general strike. Fede Cámaras, the organization of businessmen, historically opponents of the workers' organization, told businesses to close for 48 hours, which is called a lockout. Usually, a strike is workers against management, and a lockout is management against workers. In this instance, the two sides united against the president, believing that his policies were bad for them all. On April 11th, somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people turned out for a demonstration, a protest march, that would march to the headquarters of PDVSA, Venezuela's state-owned oil company. Only a few days earlier, Chavez had fired the 7-person management board of the company, on television, by blowing his baseball umpire's whistle and shouting, "You're out!" After Ortega addressed the marchers at PDVSA headquarters, he told them to march to the presidential palace. For many of the protesters, this must have been an unexpected detour, but the leaders of the workers, business owners, and media had already agreed that this strike was for the purpose of forcing the president out of office. For several days before the strike, the four main private TV stations had played hours of anti-Chavez speeches, calling for people to march in the streets and demand the president's resignation. What happened at this time is hotly debated, notwithstanding the fact that events were actually being recorded live on video. A group of Irish filmmakers, who were in the palace to film Chavez, found themselves in the unusual position of filming a coup in progress. At the presidential palace, about 5,000 Chavez supporters had gathered. When the opposition protesters arrived, the two groups began to throw stones and tear gas at each other. Then shots were fired, from both sides. One journalist who was present, Gary Wilpert, said, "I saw clearly that there were three parties involved in the shooting: the city police, anti-Chavez, Chavez supporters, and snipers from buildings above. It was impossible," he says, "to figure out who fired the first shots." Also, Wilpert does not account for the actions of the National Guard, who were pro-Chavez. In the end, about 20 people were killed and more than 100 were wounded, on both sides. Coup leaders blamed Chavez for the deaths and said that these murders were reason enough to remove him from office. While bullets flew, Chavez commandeered the TV stations, both public and private, an event common enough in Latin America that it has a name, cadena, which is to say it's not something he invented, to ask people to go home. Private stations ignored, or half-ignored, the cadena. They split the screen between Chavez and the broadcasts of the uprising, or their version of it. Their version of what was happening showed Chavez supporters shooting unarmed people from an overpass. This was contradicted by the footage shot by the Irish filmmakers. A number of senior military officers went on television calling for the president to resign, and Naval Officer Vice Admiral Hector Ramirez Perez went on the air saying, "The president of the republic has betrayed the trust of the people. He is massacring innocent people with snipers." When Chavez tried to call on the military to surround Miraflores Palace and protect him, he found that the exits from nearby military bases had been blocked and that the generals had been told to arrest him. Some of the National Guard and the Air Force had also joined the coup. Early in the morning of April 12th, General-in-Chief Lucas Rincon Romero appeared on television and said that Chavez had been asked to resign as president and had done so. Chavez said later that he had agreed to resign if that was truly the will of the people, and if certain conditions were met. He said the Constitution had to be respected, that the National Assembly had to be notified, that his vice president would be allowed to succeed him, that everyone in the palace and his family be safe, and that he be allowed to take sanctuary in Cuba. But, he says, when the news channels announced his resignation, he had not resigned, and as he was told that his demands were unacceptable, he would not resign. He was then arrested, supposedly for the deaths of the protesters, and taken to Fortiuna. He expected to be killed. That morning, Chavez discovered that some of the soldiers guarding him were still loyal to him, and he asked them for a television and a cell phone. The news programs said over and over again that he had resigned, even though he hadn't. They said the military was entirely in favor of the coup. Chavez knew that wasn't true from calls he had made the night before, and appearing on the bottom of every television screen were the words, "Chavez resigned, democracy restored." Chavez was able to reach two people by phone whom he knew he could trust, his wife and his elder daughter. His wife, Marisabel, called the U.S. news station CNN, and daughter Maria Gabriela reached Fidel Castro and told them what had happened. And so, a coup that was supported by and in part created by Venezuelan television was denounced and undone, in part, by the TV station CNN and by Radio Havana, both of which said that Chavez had in fact not resigned. But that news would not be broadcast on Venezuelan television for another day, although at least one station, Radio Caracas Television, RCTV, had been told that Chavez had been kidnapped. In the meantime, two representatives from the military legal department visited Chavez to report on his health. Since this was being treated as a resignation, there were legal formalities to be conducted. But when the representatives left Chavez, one carried with her a message on the bottom of a form. He said that he had not resigned. The chief legal officer of the government, Isaias Rodriguez, received the message by fax and then announced it on television, but the coup wasn't over yet. People watching television also saw Fede Camara's leader Pedro Carmona sworn in as interim president. Carmona then began immediately to dismantle the government. He removed Bolivarian from the country's name, dissolved the National Assembly, promising new elections for a bicameral assembly within a year, repealed the 49 laws that gave the government greater control of the economy, reinstated the old heads of Petroleos de Venezuela, the ones Chavez had fired, and dismissed the Supreme Court and other judges. He also suspended the Constitution. Carmona made a number of errors. He failed to give Carlos Ortega, who had helped engineer the coup, a role in the new government. Worse, from the standpoint of creating a stable situation, Carmona began to dismantle the high command of the armed forces. He wanted to eliminate Chavez's old supporters in the military, but he also dismissed General Vázquez Velasco, who had helped carry out the coup. He thus insulted and alienated people who had helped him and whose help he still needed very badly. Chavez had seemed too far to the left and not democratic enough to many people, but he had at least been elected. Carmona, coming into power through a coup, or he claimed a power vacuum, not through an election, was immediately showing himself to be more authoritarian, no more democratic, and too far to the right. He had dissolved the government except for himself. He was acting like a dictator. The uprising of pro-Chavez forces, including the presidential guard, began even before the news was broadcast that Chavez had not resigned. But the news got out anyway. Although Venezuela's telephone system still didn't work very well, people's cell phones worked just fine, and by April 13th, about 100,000 Chavez supporters had taken to the streets around the palace. Of foreign governments in the Western Hemisphere, only the United States and El Salvador had recognized the new government. That is not the only reason why Chavez would claim, and still claims, that the United States had a role in the coup. It was clear that the U.S. government welcomed it. Otto Reich, a former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, called a meeting at his Washington, D.C. office and told ambassadors from Latin America and the Caribbean that the coup was not a threat to democracy and that it was, rather, Chavez's anti-democratic behavior that was the threat. Later, evidence would show that Washington knew a week ahead of time of the coup. Also, the United States has funded anti-Chavez organizations at the time of the coup and since then. Other Latin American governments, not all of them famous for their respect for the democratic process, refused to recognize the new government. As one Mexican newspaper said, if this uprising in Caracas had been tolerated, it wouldn't be long before this could have blown up in the face of other democracies. The coup ended on April 13th, just 2 days after it had begun. Chavez was still at the military base in Turiamo. The soldier who brought him breakfast told him that Commander Baduel of the parachute regiment at Maracay, where Chavez had once been stationed, was refusing to take orders from Carmona's government. But a plan to free Chavez was foiled when the coup supporters moved him to the small offshore island of La Orchila. Carmona planned to meet with media leaders, who were coup supporters, but when the media arrived at Miraflores, they found the palace surrounded by Chavistas, Chavez supporters. News that parts of the military were refusing to accept the new government was getting around. The poor who lived in the hills around the center of Caracas were streaming into the city. The commander of the president's honor guard, Colonel Moral, and the guard retook the palace, showing that the soldiers guarding Carmona were not in fact loyal to him, and he was obliged to flee. He was arrested later that day. At a meeting held by General Vasquez Velasco, officers questioned whether Chavez had in fact resigned, and they objected anyway to the dismantling of the government, which they had not been warned about and had not agreed to. So even some officers who might otherwise have supported a new government refused to accept Carmona and his policies. His behavior in office made many people believe that what had happened was not, in fact, a popular uprising, but rather a coup d'etat begun by business interests, including those who owned the TV stations. Chavez was returned to Miraflores at 3:45 a.m., Sunday, April 14th. It was the shortest coup in Venezuelan history. Supporters banged pots and pans in the streets to welcome Chavez back. The president of the stock exchange told a reporter that in the wealthier parts of the city, it was like the boogeyman had come back. People were crying in church. For some Venezuelans, the attempted coup, like the riot in 1989, was a wake-up call. The wife of a wealthy businessman told New York Times reporter Deborah Sontag, "In the last 20 to 30 years, the private leadership of the country fell in love with the ease of accumulating wealth. We have neglected our society's institutions and let them get corrupt. I know I sound like Chavez, but his arguments about what is wrong with our country are the same as mine. His solutions are back to the Stone Age, but his diagnosis is correct." Another woman told a colonel of the Presidential Guard, "I wasn't a Chavista before the coup, but when I contemplated a dictatorship of the oligarchy, I remembered why we elected Chavez in the first place." 2 weeks after the coup, Chavez appeared on Alo Presidente, with the portrait of Jesus to his right and that of Simón Bolívar to his left, and delivered an unscripted 3-hour address on subjects that ranged from details of what had happened when he was deposed to details about the kinds of trees on his patio. Usually quick to spot plots and make accusations, which he would also do eventually, in this telecast, he instead emphasized that he was a good Christian who forgave his enemies, and far from being a Caudillo, was perfectly willing to have the country call a referendum in 2003 as allowed by the Constitution, and then, democratically, vote him out of office if they wanted. "Those who don't want Hugo Chavez to be president of the Republic? Fine, go organize yourself." In the wake of the attempted coup, Chavez fired and replaced generals who had not been loyal to him. The Venezuelan Supreme Court ruled in 2002 that the events in April had been a power vacuum rather than a coup d'etat, and it dismissed charges against 4 military officers. They went free amidst public protests. Chavez accepted the court's ruling, but would later pursue Ortega for his role in the coup. And in 2004, the Supreme Court ruled that the hearing had been invalid, so it is possible that the officers will face charges. The coup further divided the Venezuelan people. Some became loyal to Chavez after the coup, preferring an elected, though left-wing, leader to the alternative that presented itself, but by and large, Chavez's opponents remained his opponents. Efforts to remove him from the presidency would continue. The coup also shook up Chavez's private life. 2 months after the coup, in June of 2002, his wife left him. The divorce became final in January of 2004, and she was awarded custody of their 6-year-old daughter, Rosa Inés. Marisabel Rodriguez had served on the National Assembly and worked on many programs, nationally and internationally, that sought to protect the rights and safety of children. She did more than most presidents' first ladies, but she had found being married to this particular president a considerable strain. She had been hospitalized for stress after his election in 1998 and had had to flee the presidential palace with the children. She said, "I can't carry on subjecting the children to the stress of living in a place where we've had to run away 3 times, practically with our possessions tied in a bundle and hanging from a stick. That's no life for anyone." Friends of Chavez say he is not a good communicator either with his wife or with his children. Weeks before the coup, Marisabel had been interviewed by a magazine and had spoken about how difficult she found her life in the palace. She had wanted to marry the man, she said, and to raise their daughter and her son together. She hadn't realized she was marrying the Bolivarian Revolution. The cover of the magazine had shown her weeping. They had little left in common but their daughter, she said. Captions to photographs. 1. Supporters of ousted President Hugo Chavez burned tires in the streets of Caracas on April 13, 2002. 2. Businessman Pedro Carmona was sworn in as interim president, for a day, during the failed coup against Hugo Chavez. End of captions. General Strike. Beginning on December 2, 2002, PDVSA workers went on strike. Although the petroleum company had been nationalized 25 years earlier, most of the profits had continued to go to a relatively small group of people. The strike, by workers, and the lockout, by owners, was historically unusual, a coming together of oil workers, union members, and Fedecameras members, owners, who shut down Venezuela's oil industry for 2 months. The action, an economic coup rather than a political one, was intended to force Chavez's resignation by shutting down Venezuela's economy. The slogan of the shutdown was, "A Christmas Without Chavez." The strike created a great deal of hardship for Venezuela's people. Not only was gas in such short supply that the country had to import it, and there were still long lines at gas stations, but there were power failures and interruptions of public transportation services. Food became scarce. Chavez says of that time, "The Venezuelan establishment and their international allies sabotaged the oil refineries, threw away millions of liters of milk and slaughtered cattle so there would be no food." Chavez and his supporters called it the oil terror instead of the oil strike. He bought milk, meat, and gas from Colombia and accepted a whole ship full of beans from Cuba. "Pay whenever you can," he reports Castro as saying. In early January 2003, when the strike had already been going on longer than anyone had imagined was possible, Chavez called in the military to guard ports and oil pipelines. The military also kept schools and banks open. He then fired the oil company's directors and appointed a new minister of oil. Eventually, 18,000 people working for the oil industry, out of about 40,000, would lose their jobs. After 63 days, the strike ended as a victory for Chavez. He was in control of the oil industry and had eliminated both unnecessary workers and personal opponents. Like most of Chavez's actions, this one would be controversial. The courts said that the firings weren't legal. People who lost their jobs could not get new ones, and so many skilled workers left the country. But the United States had not come to the support of the oil industry. The United States had been less supportive of the oil industry shutdown than the coup, because by then it had invaded Iraq. The country's attention was on that war, and a Venezuelan oil shutdown simply meant that an important source of oil for the United States became unavailable. The implications for Venezuela were more complex. The economy took a severe blow. When people, in and out of the country, spoke or wrote in 2003 of Chavez's failures to improve people's lives and end poverty, they tend not to take into account the effects on the economy of over 2 months of complete economic disruption. Caption to photograph. The Venezuelan Workers' Confederation, led by Carlos Ortega, agreed to a strike in April 2002 to protest President Chavez's administration. End of caption. Chapter 9. Missions and Oppositions. One of the outcomes of the strike that the strikers hadn't foreseen was the government takeover of the oil industry. With the industry's billions of dollars per year now available to the government, Chavez was able to greatly enlarge his programs for the poor. The nationwide programs, called misiones, involve, among other things, health, education, job training, and subsidized food. These include Misión Barrio Adentro. 8,000 Cuban doctors were brought in, the number would later go up to 13,000, to bring medical care, including dental and eye care, to cities and towns. Cuba provided doctors to Venezuela in exchange for cheap oil. As part of that same agreement, Cuba also sent thousands of sports instructors and teachers. Misión Robinson, begun in 2003, was named for Simón Rodríguez, Simón Bolívar's tutor, mentor, and friend, who called himself Samuel Robinson in honor of the fictional character Robinson Crusoe. In the novel, the character lived for 28 years on an island in the Venezuelan River of Orinoco. Crusoe was resourceful and creative and very good at figuring out how to do things that no one had taught him to do. Misión Robinson provides education, literacy skills, and arithmetic, for adults. It isn't just a program that offers people classes, but it includes television programs, also the televisions, although many Venezuelans have those, reading glasses, and materials translated into many indigenous languages. An estimated 1.5 million adults were illiterate when Chavez was elected. Another literacy program serves high school dropouts. In 2004, for instance, about 600,000 students began a two-year program in which they are paid a small amount of money to help them support themselves while they take courses at night in subjects like math, geography, grammar, and foreign languages. Other misiones prepare high school graduates for university, help unemployed people find jobs, and provide subsidized food and housing. Additionally, there are misiones that give land to the poor and to indigenous communities. Chavez's opponents raise the objection that he is bypassing existing government departments and creating a welfare state in which people will learn to expect everything to be handed to them for free. They also argue that he is buying votes by buying the love and loyalty of the poor. Certainly, some of the misiones function to provide him with loyal voters. Misión Identidad, begun in 2004, helps people register to vote, including the many people who do not have proper papers, a common problem among poor people, who are less likely to have been born in a hospital or to have their births recorded by the state. The program also helps immigrants from Europe and other Latin American countries to register. And it is true that Chavez bypasses other systems for his misiones, sometimes for efficiency, because the older systems were bloated and moribund. This is the country where citizens had had to bribe tax collectors in order to be able to pay their taxes, and to bribe phone company employees to have any chance of getting a phone. At other times, Chavez may be avoiding using existing systems because he wishes to annoy opponents. Misión Mercal, for instance, builds and operates alternative supermarkets, creating a source of cheap, good-quality, government-subsidized food. Misión Mercal doesn't have to pay import duties, and so can provide high-quality Uruguayan and Argentinian beef very cheaply. This serves both to provide food, including rice, beans, and other staples, to people who need it at a price they can afford, and as a slap at Venezuela's cattle ranchers who have not been among Chavez's supporters. One of his opponents who said, "The poor may love Chavez, but they don't eat any better," is wrong. The beneficiaries of Misión Mercal not only eat better, but also are very proud of being able to buy good quality food. The misiones provide things that people need to the very people whose needs have historically been ignored in Venezuela. They mean that more people can get to computers, provided in free computer centers, and fill out job applications, and that women who work outside the home have access to daycare for their children. People in need of life-saving medical care have access to it, easy access, because one of the goals of the medical misiones is to establish community and local medical care so that people who are sick or elderly do not have to travel long distances to get help. And so the misiones have indeed helped create Chavez supporters. When reporter Alma Guillermo Prieto spoke to people helped by the misiones, she found people who had been given hope for the first time. Chavez is sometimes criticized for being a dreamer. Whether the misiones are sustainable, they are currently funded by the huge oil surplus, and if that went away, so would the misiones, is a big question. But how the misiones have been implemented shows both Chavez's strengths and weaknesses as a leader. He has allowed himself to use them to annoy people he dislikes, the ranchers, for instance. Venezuelan doctors also complain that Chavez is funding the Cuban doctors but not supporting existing clinics or facilities. Yet he has succeeded in getting help to at least some of the places where it is most needed. When Guillermo Prieto visited a small group of women at a sort of improvised misión headquarters in an empanada stand in a poor neighborhood in Caracas, the women had charts of all the locally available misiones and of what was provided by them. One of the problems of setting up new social programs is making sure that people, including people who are illiterate or don't trust the government, know what kind of help is available and how to get it. Local headquarters work. But when Guillermo Prieto asked a woman at a medical program what she liked best about Chavez and his missions, the answer wasn't about the programs. "I'm just in love with him. He's gorgeous," the woman said. It doesn't hurt a politician to be loved by the voters, but many people who follow Chavez's career believe that too much of his appeal has been personal charm and his claim to want to help everyone, or at least everyone poor. Chavez has always encouraged people to speak to him personally, to pass him slips of paper asking for help. This means that individuals, poor farmers who are not being paid properly for their work, illegal immigrants, parents who are concerned about a child's schooling, are sometimes offered the president's personal help with their problems. The result is that people travel for days to wait outside the palace to speak with him, to press pieces of paper with requests into his hand, and then assistants try to keep up with the requests. There are long lines of people waiting to see him and rooms of scraps of paper. People who don't catch his eye or happen to come at a bad time may not have their requests heard, no matter how important or justified their request. Chavez likes the idea of people being able to come to him directly, yet it's a questionable way to run a country, making everything dependent on chance and how the president is feeling that day. It makes the government too much about him. Having people bring him requests resembles the tradition of people's pinning prayers or requests to a shrine or a statue in church, which is, of course, a tradition familiar and comfortable to many of the Catholics of Venezuela. It is related to his bypassing existing systems, like hospitals, to put his own healthcare systems in place. That style of governing both reflects and encourages the belief that everything that came before Chavez was corrupt or useless, and that everything good comes directly from him. Caption to photograph. A Cuban doctor examines a child in a medical center in the shanty town of Resplandor in Caracas on July 15, 2003. The medical center is part of Chavez's Misión Barrio program. End of caption. Recall. In August of 2004, the opposition to Chavez again attempted to remove him from power, this time by constitutional means. Chavez had built into the 1999 Constitution a presidential recall provision. If the signatures of 20% of voters could be collected on petitions, then a binding vote had to be held to decide if the president should or should not remain in office. The collection of signatures began in early to mid-2003, and by August, over 3 million signatures had been collected. When the National Electoral Council, CNE, rejected the first lists, claiming that many were invalid, another signature drive produced 3.6 million signatures by the end of the year. On August 15, 2004, the recall referendum was defeated, 59% to 41%, keeping Chavez in office until the end of his term. A significant number of voters, 30% of those registered, abstained, but the vote was overseen and certified by both the Carter Center and the Organization of American States. Nevertheless, the opposition, which had insisted on the presence of these outside agencies to guarantee fairness, disputed the vote, which polls had told them they would win. Chavez did not use his victory to try to heal the ever-growing breach between Chavistas and non-Chavistas. He seems to thrive on the polarization of there being good guys and bad guys. He uses criticism from his opponents, in Venezuela or in other countries, to consolidate his power, even when the vote shows that he has a majority of people supporting him, and he could afford to be more generous to his opponents and to listen to their concerns. Venezuelans who signed the petition calling for the recall vote found themselves on a list, called simply The List, La Lista, which was, and perhaps still is, referred to when people apply for jobs or help from any of the misiones. Thus, citizens are being harmed for having used a right granted to them by their constitution. This obviously worries people who are concerned with Chavez's use of his power. People working for Sumate, a group that worked to collect signatures for the recall referendum, are being accused of conspiracy to destroy the Republican form of government and face the possibility of 8 to 16 years in jail. The accusation is based on Sumate's having accepted a relatively small amount of money from the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy. Additionally, in March 2005, the Chavez government passed laws regulating the media. Defenders of Chavez had earlier pointed out that his government remained liberal about its critics. But as of March 2005, disrespect of public officials on TV and in newspapers or magazines became a criminal offense carrying prison sentences of up to 40 months. Although these new laws have not been enforced regularly, they constitute a chipping away of freedoms and further, and perhaps unnecessarily, hamper the political opposition's effectiveness. For the last few years, the opposition has been so ineffective that Chavez probably doesn't need to take away their freedoms to stay in power. The habit of going out of his way to annoy his opponents and polarize issues is evident in Chavez's international as well as domestic discourse. Since the coup of 2002 and the recall referendum, Chavez has often accused the United States administration of plotting coups or assassinations, claiming to have spotted ships or planes off the coast. That the administration of George W. Bush knew about the coup before it happened and later gave moral support and money to Venezuelan groups involved in the recall referendum only makes Chavez's other claims easier to believe. When Pat Robertson, a high-profile TV evangelist with ties to the White House, called for Chavez's assassination, Chavez was presumably delighted. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.